You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards Tiekert. Housing has come to dominate our politics here like no time in my memory. And I'm not just talking about high rents, but really profound debates over who is making money off skyrocketing real estate, what is getting built, and who it is getting built for. Now, these are really fraught questions everywhere in America, where it's almost impossible to disentangle the politics of place from the politics of race. And that is the topic of our next guest's film. Giorgio Angelini is director of Owned, A Tale of Two Americas, which will be playing at the San Francisco Documentary Film Festival tonight at 9:30 p.m. at the Roxy in San Francisco. Giorgio, thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
I want to start where you start the film, at least where you start off spending a substantial amount of time. This is in America's archetypal suburb, Levittown, on Long Island.
Levittown is a funny, strange place that's sort of central to the story of post-war America. It's the model by which most American cities has been built upon, sort of tract home suburban development. And it was a story I thought I was familiar with, but, you know, as documentaries go, you discover more and the story unfolds in ways you didn't expect. And
what did you discover about Levittown?
Well, you know, the movie started for me really as a sort of investigation of suburban development. I was in grad school for architecture at Rice University, and it was in the middle of the housing crisis, in the middle of what everyone was sort of billing as this recovery period. And it just felt like, what were we actually recovering to, and what were we actually building? That there weren't really, it didn't seem to me that we were asking the right questions about what was being recovered. So I went to Levittown, and it took a while to find the right story, but I found through a mutual friend a group of retired police officers that had been living there for years. Curiously, they had all have very similar stories, very similar personal stories.
When I was 6 months old, we moved from Little Italy in Manhattan to this area right here. It was a housing project.
All grew up in neighborhoods in inner city New York that we now consider to be historically black neighborhoods, like Bed-Stuy and South Bronx. They were living in affordable housing complexes that were integrated with all sorts of folks, Puerto Ricans, blacks, Chinese people, everyone.
One night, my Uncle Frank was over with his wife, and a mob of guys came down his path, all Italian guys, with bats and belts and sticks. They were on their way to fight a bunch of black guys. And they walked past us, and my Uncle Frank said to my father, "Get this kid, get him out of this neighborhood and move."
And it was after the war and the creation of the GI Bill and the underwriting of a lot of neighborhoods like Levittown that a lot of these white families were plucked out of these situations and plopped out in these newly developed suburbs. And these group of guys became police officers, and most of them came back to police the very same neighborhoods that they once grew up in. And I don't know, it's this sort of twisted irony of it all, but it felt like maybe it's me projecting, but it's hard to separate that experience with sort of the way that they look at the world. That there's sort of a guilt, it feels like, that they carry.
So these big tract home complexes, mm-hmm. the American suburb that was built in the post-war period. I think probably a lot of our listeners are familiar with this as kind of one of the engines of middle-class prosperity, cheap housing in the suburbs. And also one of the engines of a consumer society and consumer economy, because once you got a house, you got to fill it up with products.
Right.
Two other things that don't always make the narrative that are in your film. One is Levittown didn't let African Americans move in.
Right. Yeah. It was built right into the contract. Literally stated that only people of Caucasian background could lease and then lease to own a home in Levittown. And for me, filming the movie, I was following Jimmy, one of the central characters, and he was giving us a tour of the neighborhood, and very proud of the neighborhood, you know, that it's a blue-collar town, the kind of town that, when America sends its kids to fight wars, they're from places like Levittown, and in many ways he's right, but he sort of pauses all of a sudden in the middle of driving and kind of looks wistfully out of the window and says, you know,
"The only thing that Levitt did that was wrong, and I'll be the first one to admit this, no blacks allowed. No blacks allowed. And that is disgraceful."
and he just kind of looked out of the window, and everyone, it was me and my two camera people in the car, we just went dead silent because I felt silly for not knowing that part of the story. I was really just there for a different kind of story, and then the whole film changed for me at that moment.
Because the neighborhood that he and other working class whites are leaving becomes a scene of disinvestment.
Exactly.
And urban decay.
Exactly.
Because the capital is following the white people to the suburbs.
Precisely. Yeah, and it wasn't just, you know, it was a combination of things. The government wasn't just underwriting loans for people, white families, to own these homes. They were also underwriting the loans for the developers themselves to build these homes at the expense of other people. And, you know, it's a part of American history, like you said, that it built the American middle class. And in a paradoxical way, it was really effective. I mean, there was a sort of depression on the horizon after the war. You know, what are we going to do with all these people? They need houses. We need jobs for them. We have this giant war machine that was building tanks and planes and battleships. And now we need to build something else. And it's like, oh, how about we build houses? And we'll build a middle class through home ownership, and people can build equity in these homes, and then they can retire on them. And then, you know, in many ways that was successful, but only for a certain group of people.
For white people.
For white people, yeah.
Yeah. The other nugget of historical context that you surface in the film, which I also don't think is in wide public currency, is that the creator of Levittown also had a somewhat ideological agenda.
Mm-hmm.
Go back to William Levitt. He said, no man who owns his own home and lot can be a communist because he has too much to do.
Yeah, it's if you have a stake in the system, you won't rise up because you're incentivized to keep the status quo the way it is. There's a really, I kind of lament we couldn't get this quote into the film because I only discovered it after we locked the edit, but William Levitt, the developer of Levittown, said, you know, I can fix the housing crisis, or I can try to fix the segregation crisis, but I can't do both.
You know? Why? I mean, why not just create integrated neighborhoods? Why would that have been so hard?
The film, at its core, to me, is really an interrogation of the concept of value. You know, it's a very loaded term, obviously, both literal value and then sort of ethical values. And these government policies that were put in place after the war were built on this disturbing delusion that black people living in your neighborhood would inherently bring property values down. And so if those are the values that you hold, then this becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. I mean, there's a really poignant moment of one of the archival pieces that we use from a documentary called Crisis in Levittown, where a journalist is interviewing people in the 50s in Levittown when the first black family moves into town. And one woman says, you know, I moved to Levittown because I thought it was going to be all white and I wanted to keep it that way because I don't want my property values to go down. And another woman he interviews says, you know, the crisis of values is not, it's a white people problem, not a black people problem. And I think it's unfortunately as simple as that. It's, you know, it was a perception issue that got manifested in a really horrendous network of bad policy that created the conditions that we're currently experiencing now.
So you have an interesting kind of contrast suburb from the same era, Mar Vista,
mm-hmm.
in Southern
yeah.
California. This was kind of conceptualized by a socialist visionary.
Yeah, that's right. Gregory Ain. Yeah.
So why don't you describe the salient differences between Mar Vista and Levittown?
Yeah, Mar Vista, I initially approached the story there because I was an architect and I was really in love with these homes. So it was a famous, well, relatively famous modernist architect named Gregory Ain, who moved to Southern California, like many early modernist architects, with sort of socialist visions of utopia. I think that's one thing that gets lost in post-war housing as an ideology. It's like modern architects saw the sort of ease of construction and the cheapness of construction as a way of democratizing housing. And so for Gregory, when he wanted to develop this little area of Mar Vista, it was exactly the same time as at Levittown. And he was using the very same principles that William Levitt was using of cheapness and prefabrication and all these things. But there was a social component to the design as well. First and foremost, it was going to be an integrated neighborhood. And then there were other sort of design elements like lawns running one to the next, no fence lines, just the physicality of the space sort of feels more open. I don't know. It's a profound experience to walk through that neighborhood and then out of the neighborhood, and you can really feel the palpable difference. And as a designer, it's a really interesting study in these nuances. But because he wanted to make it integrated, the FHA wouldn't underwrite the loans because they too were subject to this ideology.
The Federal Housing Administration.
The Federal Housing Administration wouldn't underwrite the loans for these homes because they too, of course, fell victim to the same poisonous ideology that if we underwrite these loans and you let black families into this neighborhoods, those loans will be valueless because it'll bring the property values down. So Gregory had to basically go through a patron model to build those homes. It was supposed to be probably five times bigger than it wound up being. But it's an interesting community because the people who bankrolled it were part of the same people that were involved in the Blacklist saga in Hollywood. So there's a moment in the film where we interview Gregory Ian's daughter, who recently found out that the FBI had 200, 300 pages on him, on her father, Gregory Ian. They'd been following him for like 20 years.
Yeah. It's kind of shocking to me to see the footage of this beautiful mid-century modernist architecture on leafy, tree-lined streets and get that context from the film and kind of think, oh, you know, communists, it's not all brutalism. They can build some pretty things too.
Exactly. Yeah, he's a really fascinating character. I mean, his father fought in the Bolshevik Revolution. He grew up in a commune in the desert in California. And he unfortunately didn't really rise to prominence until much later after his death. But he worked with some of the greats. And Mar Vista today, the great irony is that it's some of the most expensive houses in Los Angeles.
Because they're nice.
Yeah, they're really beautiful.
Speaking of Giorgio Angelini, he is director of Owned, A Tale of Two Americas, which will be playing at the San Francisco Documentary Film Festival tonight, 9:30 p.m. at the Roxy. You spend a lot of time in Baltimore, and specifically in inner city Baltimore, the part of the city that was hollowed out and kind of burnt out by white flight. How did you pick Baltimore as the city to tell that story?
The history was unfolding around us while we were filming this movie, and when we were trying to figure out what would be the counterpoint of the Levittown story.
You mean the Freddie Gray protests?
Correct. Yeah. I happened to be filming in Levittown while that was going on. And these ex-cops that I was with, you know, on one hand, they were in some way empathetic to the plight and understanding that the communities were rough and saying, you know, I can understand why they're protesting. I fought for their right to protest, but how can you burn your own neighborhood down? And I thought that was a really important question for this film to try and answer for that type of perception. So I went to Baltimore looking for a storyline and met some really incredible people and found out that actually Baltimore happens to be the place where many of the techniques for racial segregation and racist covenants and all the ways that municipalities and zoning works to divide people really was born in Baltimore. And so it is the extreme physical manifestation of all these policies. And for people who have never really been to Baltimore, me being one of them, or I'd only seen one part of it many years ago, it's a national tragedy. And I think you walk through there and you can't believe that you're in the United States.
One of the interesting backstories to Baltimore is that when it went through the process of white flight, there was a deliberate blockbusting technique that was pursued by real estate interests, which was bring in an African-American family to drive the rest of the white families out. And the goal was to get white families to sell cheap because the neighborhood was going to hell. And to sell to black Americans who had to buy high because they didn't have access to the subsidized loans that white families did. It's an incredibly cynical window into American capitalism.
Yeah. Terrible. I mean, you hear about it a lot. I think probably most foundationally for me and the way I was thinking about it was Ta-Nehisi Coates' article about the case for reparations. And he looks at it through Chicago, but it's very similar, very cynical process. But also what's interesting about Baltimore, it's not just white flight that really hollowed out the city. In many ways, Baltimore is no different than a lot of these Midwest towns, these sort of Trump country or coal country that was just demolished by post-industrialization. You know, you had, I think, over 100,000 manufacturing jobs leave the city over the last several decades. And it's not that big of a city. Without reinvestment, it just the city just crumbles. And the way the city itself is set up, you have Baltimore County on the outskirts and Baltimore City internally, which again to me is like a continuation of this incredibly cynical view of like how as a city we reflect our values by building essentially tax schemes to funnel money to certain areas and deprive others.
Let's take a quick trip to the final place you profile in the film. And this is the great sprawling interior heartland of Southern California, mm-hmm. one of the areas that took the wildest ride on the real estate bubble
yeah.
that hit in the mid-aughts, where you found a realtor who is warning of another bubble in the works.
That's correct. Yeah. His name is, he goes by Jim the Realtor. He was one of the more vocal people online with his blog talking about just shouting from the hilltops in the midst of the crisis that certain people weren't being held accountable. But it was a really interesting viewpoint into this utopic world that is Southern California and this guy at the center of it all who's both selling the American dream but also highly critical of it. That's really where the story started for me. I mean, I had gotten a grant during grad school in architecture to go photograph these abandoned McMansions in Inland Empire, California. And for those who haven't been to Inland Empire, California, I'm not sure why you would go because there's not really any reason to be there except to buy a really large home. But during the crisis, it's like 2011, 2012, you just had these abandoned McMansions of 5,000 to 10,000 square foot homes sitting alongside these burnt down orange groves. And it was a really striking image to see sort of this commodity shift frozen in time. Like you could tell that the area was once replete with farming and orange groves, and that they'd sort of made the value judgment that instead of the unit of value being oranges, it was going to be conditioned square feet because that was better land use. And no one ever stopped to think like, well, does anyone really need a 5,000 square foot home? And, you know, when money was as cheap as it was, you didn't have to make those value judgments. And so that was sort of ground zero for me to really understanding just how mindless the process of development had become. It was just like a machine carpeting the earth with these homes without any sort of consideration for the culture it was creating, the spaces it was creating. There was this one home that I came across it's featured in the film. It's where we do this long time lapse of it. But it's this big suburban home that at that time was empty. And it was sort of precariously placed on this incredible cliff face that's overlooking orange groves and a big reservoir and these high desert mountains. And the only window that's facing that incredible view is like a small bathroom window. And I thought, like, what better representation of just the mindlessness of capital accumulation than that home? It's like no one was even present enough to say, what if we just turn this home this way and had the living room look out this incredible view?
So in the driver's seat on the construction of that landscape, it seems to be the world of finance, right? There are financial institutions constantly trying to figure out how they can lend more money to more people.
Right.
And then the people naturally are trying to figure out how they can use all the money that is newly available to them to buy more house.
Right.
That popped. It wiped a lot of people out. You start with a narrative about post-war housing policy, aspiring to create a stable middle class in America. And in the process, worsening the racial inequalities that already existed in this country. So how do we think about the period where finance capital is driving these sprawling developments that are less middle class and more aspirationally wealthy?
It's a really difficult conundrum because some market purists will say like, well, everyone should have access to homes, so we should make it as easy as possible to buy homes. But the problem is that over that time, since we've divested from, you know, the creation of affordable housing, in the run-up to the bubble, you had a lot of people whose only opportunity for stable housing was to get themselves into these really crazy sort of what they call NINA loans, no income, no asset loans. Because if you're looking on TV and someone says, hey, no money down, we can give you $400,000 to go buy the house of your dreams, and you have no options for affordable housing, your Section 8 vouchers don't work anywhere, everyone's going to take that deal out of desperation, at the very least, or just wanting to move into a neighborhood that has better schools and is cleaner and any numerous reasons that every human would want to move to a better neighborhood. So I think when we look at the housing crisis, we don't look at it fully enough to see it as a sort of the flip side of what happens when you hollow out housing policy the way we have. And of course, today we have, you know, Dr. Ben Carson as the head of HUD. So it kind of shows you what little regard the government has for housing policy.
Well, it's a fascinating film. I really appreciate you taking the time to come speak to us about it.
Thank you for having me.
Giorgio Angelini is director of Owned, A Tale of Two Americas. That is playing at the San Francisco Documentary Film Festival. The last screening is tonight at 9:30 p.m. at the Roxy in San Francisco. And as luck would have it, we have two pairs of tickets to give away to that screening. Call 510-848-4425, and lucky callers 5 and 10 will each get a pair of tickets. That's 510-848-4425.
The most tangible cornerstone that lies at the heart of the American dream, and that's the chance to own your own home.
Those of us who have been given positions of responsibility must do everything we can to spotlight the dream and to make sure the dream shines in all neighborhoods.
All across the country, I say to millions of young working couples, by the time your children are ready to start the first grade, we want you to be able to own your own home.
Because in order to be secure in their human rights, people need access to property rights.
We must make sure that every family in America lives in a home of dignity, a neighborhood of pride, and a community of opportunity.